The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Very nice to see you. On my shelf at home, I have a book by Robert Greene called The 48 Laws of Power. I'm not sure where exactly I got the book, but it's very interesting. Some of his laws, basically, what is he saying? He talks about the use of power over the ages, and talks about the courts of the European courts of kings and queens in the Middle Ages, and says the following. Our world similarly imagines itself to be the pinnacle of fairness, yet the same ugly emotions will stir within us as they have forever. The game is the same. Outwardly, you must seem to respect the niceties, but inwardly, unless you are a fool, you learn quickly to be prudent, to do as Napoleon advised, quote, place your iron hand inside the velvet glove. If, like the courtier of times gone by, you can master the arts of indirection, learning to seduce, charm, deceive, and subtly outmaneuver your opponents, you will attain the heights of power. And some of the 48 laws that you might like to read about. Law 1, never outshine the master. Law 3, conceal your intentions. Law 4, always say less than, well, that's enough of that. Get others to do the work for you. Always take the credit. Infection. Avoid the unhappy and the unlucky. Use selective honesty and generosity to disarm your victim. Be royal in your own fashion. Act like a king to be treated like one. And on it goes. Now, he says that he's researched over 3,000 years of writing of people who've understood power and taken power. For example, Sun Tzu and The Art of War, the writings of Otto von Bismarck, Prince Machiavelli gets a big mention. What's interesting in his 48 Laws of Power, there's one very significant and influential teacher who doesn't get a mention. He's not quoted in the entire book. You can possibly imagine who that might be. That very influential teacher says, I guess what I might list is the 49th law of power, the complete opposite of what Robert Greene is saying. He says, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. Now, I can imagine a first century publisher saying, nah, that'll never sell. Of course, they are the words of Jesus of Nazareth, and inside your program is the context in which Jesus says it. And so what I'd like to do is look at the context of what Jesus says, at the influence of what Jesus says, and some of the implications, all in about 20 minutes, so I'll be going very quickly. If you look at your program, part of Mark's gospel is printed out there, and I think Mark intends for us to read it as a unit. I won't be able to look at the whole thing, but the way to tell, for example, if you notice verse 32, Jesus is leading the way, the Greek word hodos, right, the way, and then look at verse 52, the beggar follows Jesus along, the NIV's gone for the road, but that's a mistake. It should be translated, it can translate it that way, but it should be translated, it's the same word, it should be the way. And if you read the book of Acts, the history of the early church in the New Testament, until the middle of the book of Acts, Christians were called followers of the way. This is how to live as a follower of Jesus. Also, you notice there's the two questions. In verse 36, James and John come to Jesus and ask Jesus asks him, what do you want me to do for you? And then in verse 52, Jesus asks the beggar, Jesus asks the beggar, what do you want me to do for you? And they're totally different answers to that question. And I'll leave you to read the section about the beggar and compare the two later on. I just don't have time to deal with that, but it's a beautifully written piece of storytelling. Now, what helps us understand today what Jesus says is the context of Mark's Gospel. Mark's Gospel divided into 16 chapters. Let me give you very quickly, the first 8 chapters, the disciples are following Jesus around, watching him. And the big question is, who is Jesus? And they see him with authority over nature, disease, evil spirits. They see him teach like no one ever has before. And finally, by the time you get to chapter 8, they've worked out that Jesus is the Messiah, God's promised king. And so Jesus says to them, "But what about you?" Jesus asks. "Who do you say I am?" Peter answered, "You are the Messiah." The Hebrew way of saying God's great king, and the Greek way would be, "You are the Christ." And then the second half is all about what has Jesus come to do. And immediately he begins to explain that, and it is not what they expect. So it's in the context, if you read Mark's Gospel, it's in the context of Jesus on his way to Jerusalem, about to sacrificially give his life for people, that James and John come to him and ask this request. So verse 35, you follow on the screen or on your program. "Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him. 'Teacher,' they said, 'we want you to do for us whatever we ask.' 'Well, what do you want me to do for you?' he asked." Actually, there's a beautiful little note in Matthew's Gospel. Matthew says it was their mother who brought them to Jesus to ask this, which is very hard to imagine unless you've had a mother. Verse 35, they replied, "Let one of us sit at your right and the other at your left in your glory." Now, what are they asking? Well, they've worked out that this man is the Messiah, God's great king. And he is on his way to Jerusalem to be enthroned, if you like, to become the great king. They are expecting this man will rule the world. And they're, if you like, they're in at the bottom, in at the ground floor. They are asking for the positions of influence, to be chief of staff, secretary of state, etc. Now, it is good that the world has moved on from this kind of crass selfishness or wanting influence. So, for example, say someone was elected or about to become ruler of a massive superpower. It's not as if today anyone would kind of lobby and try to get cabinet positions and become, have wealth and power and influence. And I just think it's good that we've moved past all of that. Now, who can, if you're listening on the tape, I just put up a thing about Donald Trump's cabinet, okay? Just anyway. Now, who can blame James and John, really? They are expecting this man will rule the world, and what are they thinking? Well, they're thinking the lodge, chauffeur-driven chariots, seven-star hotels, first-class galley travel, money, power, influence, titles, a knighthood, all that stuff. And the question you've got to ask is, are James and John complete idiots? And the answer is, yes, they are. Why? Because for the last two or three chapters, Jesus has been trying to explain to them that he's on about something completely different. In chapter 8 and chapter 9 and for the third time in chapter 10, look immediately before how Mark has put this all together. Immediately before, Jesus has explained to them what it is that he's come to do. You see verse 32, they were on their way up to Jerusalem with Jesus leading the way, and the disciples were astonished while those who followed were afraid. Again, he took the 12 aside, including James and John, and told them what was going to happen to him. "We're going up to Jerusalem," he said, "and the Son of Man," his way of talking about himself, "the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests, the teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death. They will hand him over to the Gentiles, who will mock him, spit on him, flog him, and kill him. 3 days later, he will rise." And it's against that background that James and John have just come and said, "Oh, we want to share in your glory." All I can say is, be careful what you wish for. Look at what Jesus says, verse 38. "You don't know what you're asking." And that never were truer words spoken. "You don't know what you're asking," Jesus said. "Can you drink the cup I drink, or be baptized with the baptism I'm baptized with?" The cup idea, if you read the Old Testament, to drink the cup is very often a metaphor that's used for to experience the judgment of God, or for God to punish people. So, for example, the Psalms. Psalms are like poems or songs in the Old Testament, big book of them in the middle of the Bible. Psalm 75 says, "In the hand of the Lord is a cup full of foaming wine mixed with spices. He pours it out, and all the wicked of the earth drink it down to its very dregs." God punishes, right, evil people. Now, I think the idea of foaming wine is that it's still fermenting. Perhaps someone can explain that to me later, but the idea is it's still fermenting, it's getting stronger, it's young, rough wine, it's the punishment that's poured out on people. And Jesus is asking James and John, "Are you willing to suffer with me?" Now, if you read on in chapter 14, as Jesus comes to the night before he dies and he stares into the abyss, if you like, that he prays that if there's any other alternative, God, his Father, might take the cup from him. Now, he goes ahead because that's no other alternative, but he asks, Father, if possible, take the cup from this cup of suffering. Jesus asks, are you able to suffer with me? When he says a baptism, see in verse 38, a baptism, I think he talks about in Luke's gospel, he says, I have a baptism to undergo and what constraint I'm under till it's completed. You know, we use the phrase a baptism of fire. It doesn't involve water. It's saying something very tough that you had to go through. I think he's talking about going to the cross. So what he's asking James and John is, are you able to suffer with me or like me in obedience to God? And they answer, verse 39, not understanding at all what they're saying. Ah, we can, they answer. Jesus says, you will drink the cup I drink and be baptized with the baptism I'm baptized with. In other words, yes, you will suffer. You will suffer. If you read on, in the book of Acts, we're told that King Herod had James, the brother of John, put to death with the sword. John lives on into old age in exile on the island of Patmos after being severely persecuted. So yes, they did suffer. But look at verse 40. Jesus says, yes, you will suffer. They don't know it yet, but they will. He says, but to sit at my right hand or left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they've been prepared. Now, question. They've asked to be on the right hand and the left hand when he's in his glory. When is the time, if you're familiar with the gospel stories, when is the time that there's someone on Jesus' right hand and Jesus' left hand? And you read on to chapter 15, and we're told it was 9 in the morning when they crucified him. The written notice of the charge against him read, the King of the Jews. They crucified two rebels, or robbers, with him, one on his right and one on his left. And the point being that Jesus' kingdom, Jesus' kingship will be built on sacrificial service. The great irony is the time when he most shows his glory is when he dies for others. And there'll be one on his right and one on his left. And not only have James and John not understood that, the other disciples are the same and just as selfish. And so we're told in verse 41, when the 10 heard about this, they became indignant with James and John. They're cranky that James and John have thought of this first. Well, actually it was their mum, but James and John have gone and asked first. And then Jesus pulls them together and says this. Jesus called them together and said, you know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Now, the exercise authority over them word is literally the word for lord and the prefix for over. They lord it over people. He's saying the way of the world is that those in authority use their power to suppress or to take advantage of those that they have power over. Now, what would a talk from me be without a quote from Rodney Stark? This is my latest Rodney Stark book. And if you were here last week, I did find a photo of Professor Stark smiling. There is one out there. Rodney Stark's a professor at Baylor University in Texas. His latest book, or one of his latest books, How the West Won, the History of the Western World. He says this about the ancient empires of the world. In the context, notice, of those with power lording it over those that they rule. And that Jesus is saying that's the way of the world. He says, the first empire arose in Mesopotamia more than 6,000 years ago. Then came the Egyptians, Chinese, Persians and Indian empires. All these empires suffered from chronic power struggles among the ruling elites. But aside from those, some border wars and immense public works projects, very little changed. Change, whether technological or cultural, was so slow as to go nearly unnoticed. As the centuries passed, most people lived as they always had, quote, just a notch above barest subsistence, little better off than their oxen. This was not because they lacked the potential to achieve a much higher standard of living, but because a predatory elite ruling class extracted every ounce of surplus production. All signs of resistance were brutally crushed. Now what we see, Stark goes on to say, what we see when you dig things up with archaeology is the massive monuments that people have built, that the rulers have built, and we think it was a rich empire. But no. He says, in all the ancient empires, monumentalism was rife. Pharaohs built pyramids, huge statues of the Sphinx, immense shrines, and even whole personal cities. The rulers of Mesopotamia built enormous ziggurats. And he goes on to talk about the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, etc., etc. But despite the monuments and fabulous royal wealth, the great empires were very poor. Emperors amassed vast wealth but received incomes that were nevertheless small relative to the immensity of the territories and populations they governed. Indeed, because of imperial opulence, century after century, the standard of living in China, northern India, Mesopotamia, and Egypt hovered slightly above or below what might have been called the threshold of, quote, pauperization. He quotes, "The splendours of the Asian courts merely testified that political organisation can squeeze blood out of stones if the stones were numerous enough." If I could change to a slightly different kind of cultural milieu, Peter Garrett says, "The fat cats still push the thin cats around." That's the way of the world. Now, that was the ancient world. What about the modern world? Let me give you an example, and I'm going to talk about Chinese culture. This man is Gary Locke. He was the United States Ambassador to China 2011-2014. So he's a ethnically Chinese but born in the USA. Gary Locke created a furor in China with this photograph that was taken of him. That's him at Seattle. He's buying a coffee at Starbucks. And can you see why there's a furor about... He's just been appointed Ambassador to China. So this created a social media storm, as well as this photo of him arriving at the airport in China. Can you see why the furor? Let me read to you what happened. A photograph, this is 2011, Sydney Morning Herald. A photograph taken on Friday of the new US ambassador to China, Gary Locke, buying a coffee with his six-year-old daughter and carrying a black backpack at a Starbucks in Seattle Airport has gone viral on the internet in China. The seemingly banal scene has bewildered and disarmed the Chinese because they are used to seeing their own officials indulge in privileged lives, often propped up by graft, bribery and lavish expense accounts. Locke and his family were waiting to fly to Beijing when a Chinese-American businessman took the photo and posted it on a popular Chinese social networking site. It's been reposted more than 40,000 times and has generated thousands of comments. The first impression from the Starbucks episode has been bolstered by another photograph that shows Locke and his wife Mona and their three children carrying their own luggage after landing at Beijing Capital International Airport. The Chinese who saw them then spread the word that the family had gotten into an anonymous minivan because the formal sedan that had been sent to pick them up was too small. Quote, "To most Chinese people, the scene was so unusual it defied belief." Cheng Wahu, an editor of the China Daily, an official English language newspaper, wrote in an article on Wednesday. Chen Li, a scholar at the Brookings Institute who studies Chinese elite politics, said in an email, "Ambassador Locke's photo contrasts sharply with the image of the Chinese officials who often live a secret, insulated and very privileged fashion." In 2009, President Obama, on his first trip to China, also inadvertently set off a firestorm of commentary. What did Obama do? When he stepped out of the plane in Shanghai holding his own black umbrella during a shower. Chinese officials often have aides hold umbrellas above their heads. Chen asked in the China Daily commentary on Locke, "How could someone who holds the rank of ambassador to a big country not have someone to carry his luggage and not use a chauffeured limousine? In China, even a township chief, which is not really that high up the hierarchy, will have a chauffeur and a secretary to carry his bags." He concluded, "Perhaps it's time for Chinese dignitaries to follow the example of humble Locke." Now, I know that's just anecdotal, but why is it that you did not see the furor in that the ambassador would buy his own coffee, carry his own backpack? And I'd put it to you, the reason you didn't see that is because you've grown up or spent enough time in Australia, and we have a Christian heritage about those in authority. What does Jesus say? "Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first among you must be slave of all." Jesus' teaching is this, that greatness is found in service, and that those with power should use their power to care for people and serve them. And my point is this, even if we don't do it, and often we don't, we still know that that's the right thing to do because of the influence of Jesus. Now, when our national leaders, apparent, I'm not saying they ever do, but when some people misunderstand our national leaders and think that somehow they're acting as if it's all about them, they are lampooned. Right? So, for example, this is the cartoon of Mr. Turnbull. I'm not saying Mr. Turnbull's doing this. It's just what Bill Leake thinks. But Mr. Turnbull, after the last election, dressed as Louis the 14th or 15th or 16th, and there's Malcolm Turnbull talking to Kevin Rudd, and you don't really need the words. You can see what it is that Bill Leake in The Australian is saying. When someone in public office or power uses that office for themselves, what is the word we use for it? We call it corruption. And ours is different. Here's another book that's... the book that made your world, subtitled How the Bible Created the Soul of Western Civilization. Another excellent book. Vishal Mangawati, man from India, born a Hindu, became a Christian at university. He can see how it is that the Bible and the teachings of Jesus have created Western culture. And he actually is... how can I put it, shameless in saying it, because he's an outsider, because he can see it so clearly. He speaks about, well, many issues, but speaks particularly about corruption. And what he quotes is this. Transparency International is a German non-government organisation, and they list the Global Corruption Perception Index. Basically, how corrupt a particular country is in business, government, etc., and list them. They rank from 1 to 163, I think it is. You can find it on the net very easily. Actually, number one, New Zealand. Okay. Transparency International, a German non-government organisation, has long recognised the correlation between corruption and poverty. Right? They define corruption as this. Corruption is the abuse of entrusted power for private gain. And Transparency International say, corruption corrodes the fabric of society. It undermines people's trust in political and economic systems, institutions and leaders. It can cost people their freedom, health, money, sometimes their lives. Corruption breeds poverty. You have to reduce corruption to actually create wealth. And here's what he says at the end. An important finding in the Corruption Perception Index is... that the least corrupt countries are the Protestant countries. That is, secular nations whose cultures have been shaped decisively by the Bible. The only exception is Singapore, a tiny city-state. And that is, the first 18 on the list are all those who've been shaped by the Protestant Reformation, is what he's saying. Jesus' influence has been huge in the Western world in this area. Now, I still want to say that... self-interest leaks into the boat, of course. It leaks into our, you know, with our politicians, our business leaders, and I need to say the church is a very slow-moving target in this area. So we still have bishops parading around in fine robes, wanting the right titles of Right Reverend, Very Reverend, Most Reverend, or my personal favourite, the Venerable. We have preening pastors of mega churches, or worship leaders who think they're rock stars, or baldy-headed, grumpy old men who think they're right all the time. I just needed to mention that, okay? Now, I'd even, just with all the humility I can possibly gather, which is a lot, that even the legal profession, is not completely immune from self-interest, all right? I know, just this much. But our society's conscience knows what is right in this area. Jesus is saying it's okay to want to be great, but that greatness is found in the service of others. And you know what? We know that's right. Why? I tell you why, because it reflects the character of God. Look at verse 45. What does Jesus say? For even the Son of Man, his way of speaking about himself, did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. It's the character of God, the character of God as he revealed himself in Jesus, to serve others. The word for ransom there, the Greek word lutrons, the idea of paying a price to win someone back, or to redeem, to buy someone back. And Jesus says the reason he'd come is not to be served, but to serve in giving his life to buy us back from being under God's penalty for the wrong that we've done. Now, it's easy to discuss this at the level of history and society, and I like reading books about it, and it's great, it's out there. But at a personal level, it is not It's not easy to live this way. Interesting what Robert Greene says at the very beginning of his book. He says this: the feeling of having no power over people and events is generally unbearable to us. When we feel helpless, we feel miserable. And that's, you know, there's 500 pages of how to get power over people after that quote. But what Jesus is saying is not be powerless at all. Jesus is saying power is good if you use it to serve other people. Does doing that make you a fool? Robert Greene says, "You, unless you get your own way, you're a fool." No. Well, what Jesus is saying is, it's ultimately a statement of trust that the one who has ultimate power will care for us. If we will trust him in this as we serve others, he will look after us. Now, where's this hard work? Well, pretty much everywhere, but I'd put it to you, it's hardest with the people closest to us. It's hardest at home. If you're married, it's difficult to want to serve your spouse. If you're a parent, it's difficult to want to serve your kids. I mean, the great irony is sometimes you have to serve your children, or by saying hard things to them, by disciplining them, by at work, if you have power, how do you serve and care for those who are your employees or your reports? And yet when this is actually done, it's a very powerful witness that you do trust Jesus and what he promises. And I put it to you that the reward for living this way is that you actually become like the master, who himself was the greatest servant. As usual, some very interesting questions. Sit at my right hand or left, 37 and verse 37, verse 40. Can this be read as a reference to where Jesus sits now at God's right hand? Well, in the sense that to sit at someone's right hand was to be, we still use the expression, their right-hand man, to be the one who exercises power, the one in the position of influence and power. So that's what they're asking. I don't think they're asking to sit at the right hand of God. They're saying, you're about to be king. Can we be, you know, 2IC or your chief of staff? That's what they're asking. So as it says, Jesus is seated at God's right hand. He is in the position of power and influence, the one who rules. Can you please clarify for the recording, our Kiwi brothers and sisters, that when you were talking about listing the corrupt countries, that New Zealand is number one. They're number one. Yeah, sorry, I tried a Kiwi accent there. I love Kiwis. New Zealand, one, the least corrupt country in the world, in the Global Corruption Perceptions Index, and I put that out there on the internet. I also mentioned that Ireland beat them in the rugby a couple of weeks ago. But we haven't for 13 years. Not that any of us are bitter. Does the role of evangelical Christians in the election of Donald Trump with the edifice of the Trump Tower suggest the 48 laws of power are going to prevail over the Christian heritage of the West? Big question. I don't think that Donald Trump is a genuine born-again Christian. It's not for me to judge, but from what I can tell, I don't think he is. And yet God can use those who are not believers to get his purposes done. God used Nebuchadnezzar, Cyrus, Pontius Pilate, etc. On a wider question, I think the Western world has inherited huge benefits from the Judeo-Christian worldview. In fact, we are who we are as societies because of that, the benefits that we have, the freedom, democracy, the creation of wealth, the rise of science, social welfare, the value of the value of human beings. But we have the memory of a goldfish, and as a society, we're busy running away from that and walking away from those foundations. And yes, over time, unless we actually come back, those benefits will begin to crumble. What will happen in the next 4 years? I don't know. But I don't think anybody else does either. What is the most important message from this text? that Jesus says, if we wish to trust him, if we wish to live his way, and as he says in verse 45, he has given his life so that we might be forgiven, ransomed from the penalty that we deserve, we should use whatever power we have to serve others. That greatness in his kingdom is found through serving others, not by being powerless, by using that power to serve and care for others. Does Christianity grow fastest among the powerless? In the modern world, yes. Philip Jenkins' book, The New Christendom, lists the global south as seeing massive growth in South America, in Africa, in Asia, and very often among those who are poor and who are struggling. We won't hear about it in the Western media because poor person becomes Christian in the middle of Africa is not as newsworthy as dog ride surfboard at Bondi, okay? But it's happening. Now, what is interesting, in the early times of Christianity, the gospel spread not just amongst the low class. It spread amongst the slave class, it spread amongst the poor, but it also spread amongst those who are well-to-do. And so in 1 Corinthians, Paul writes and says to the Corinthians early in that first letter, not many of you are of noble birth, not many of you are rich, etc. God chose the poor. But he doesn't say none of you. It's just, in terms of ratios, not many are the elites. But certainly there were elites who became believers. But generally, belief in Jesus and trust in God comes with those who are humble. And what Jesus warns is, it is very difficult for the rich and powerful to be humble. It's possible, but it's a miracle from God when it happens. How Christian is the West? This is the last question. How Christian is the West? I read a quote from Mr. Bolt, who writes he's the radio. Is it Andrew Bolt? And it's not. I'm not faking that. From Andrew Bolt, who said that he's not a Christian believer, but he can see the benefits of the Christian faith. And he quoted an exchange he'd had with George Pell, where George Pell accused him of living off the fat of the Christian faith. So I don't think the Western world is Christian at all, in the way that it's not Christian in terms of genuine belief and a heart devoted to following Jesus. And yet we're living off the fat of the Christian worldview. And if you want to see how it is that the Christian worldview and has resulted in so many of the good things that the Western world has, and I've listed them earlier on, here's a good place to start. Vishal Mangawati, Hindu who's become a Christian, very clearly lists how it is that the Bible created our world, or Rodney Stark, who has grown up in the Western world, also in a very politically incorrect way and entertaining, speaks about it as well.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.